Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If you're fans of the beloved Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan rom-com, Sleepless in Seattle, or You've Got Mail, you know that it's often a confluence of cascading events that bring two star-crossed lovers together. That's part of what makes them great stories, right? And remember that word, confluence. It's going to come up again later. And that's because Delia Ephron, who co-wrote both of those iconic films, has just put out another story about confluence, bringing people together, and it's her story. The memoir is called Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. It details the unusual way she met her second husband, Peter, after her beloved husband of more than 30 years, Jerry, passed away from cancer. Peter's wife had recently died as well, and their last vacation was to a place called Siracusa in Sicily. Siracusa is also the titular setting of Delia's 2016 novel. He read an op-ed Delia wrote about the enormous fight with Verizon to disconnect her spouse's phone line. He'd experienced the same thing. And oh yeah, they had been on three dates back in their college days, 54 years prior. They email back and forth for a while, and before they meet, Delia writes, quote, "We were already in love." Now, it's more complicated than a simple widow and widower in love story, because just 5 months later, Delia was diagnosed with leukemia. As she writes in the very beginning of the memoir, if you are in Manhattan traveling downtown in a car on 5th Avenue or 7th Avenue, and you want to turn onto 10th Street, you have to turn left. It's a one-way street, west to east. Left on 10th is my way home. I was left on 10th when my husband died, and after that, life took many left turns, some perilous, some wondrous. This book is about all of them. Joining us now to talk about her new memoir, Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life, is Delia Ephron. Hi, Delia.
Hi, Allison. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. Thank you for being with us.
I'm happy to be here.
As you were sitting down to work on this, and I mean, you opened the book with your husband's death. What was your process for going back to that time?
After I survived, which is told in the book, after I got through what was an immensely precarious and difficult hospital stay, I really didn't think I was ever going to write again. I was, you know, 74 or so, and I had been so depleted by attempting to survive that I thought, I'm not going to write. And then as I started to get well, my writer's heart started beating. And I thought, you just had the most amazing experience in 4 years. It has everything you could ever want in a story. I mean, enormous loss, incredible love, and then the threat of death. And then also so many strange confluences and coincidences that it makes you wonder about things like miracles. And I thought, I have to write this. I mean, life just gave me a story, a big story. And so I started to collect everything that I had. And after Jerry had died, because that night was so traumatic with, it's all in the book, but I mean, it's all about, there were all the EMTs showed up and I had all my DNR forms and everything. I just put him back in bed, please. And they refused. And I ended up in this absolutely terrible argument with five EMTs and two policemen all in my apartment and just my husband on the floor. And anyway, it had been so traumatic that I had written a piece about it and afterwards to remember it, but I didn't sell it. So I started to look in my computer at everything I had collected over those years. And that piece, which I then adapted for the book, you know, became the opening. I think if I hadn't made notes then, and I'm not a journal keeper, but I just did make notes that night. It was such an extraordinary night of survival and the loss of Jerry in the middle. It was just so rough. And yet it was also eccentric, and which, you know, I'm a writer who likes anything that's offbeat. And this was also kind of crazy. So, you know, I'm looking at it. And anyway, so I started to collect everything. And then I had somebody collect every email I had exchanged for the last 4 years, as well as notes. And she put them in six gigantic loose leaf binders chronologically. And I just sat down and I started to write. And I had had so much trauma mm-hmm. from surviving leukemia. So much trauma. I think almost everyone who goes through a stem cell transplant, which my husband, Peter, thinks is like akin to a heart transplant. I mean, your blood, the marrow is what creates your blood. This is central, and they completely redo your marrow. I went from being type O blood to type A blood. I mean, it's really, and so I was traumatized. And as I started to shape this into a story and use all my talents about drama and how to, I like to keep people turning the page. It's a big thing with me. Anyway, so I began to not totally get rid of the trauma, but do an enormous amount of processing of it. So it was actually a great joy to write.
You know, that's the first scene you mentioned, it's so frustrating. Your husband has a DNR. I believe it was a hospice worker told you if you call first responders and they come, you just tell them they want to put your husband back in the bed. Mm-hmm. And you get into this back and forth with them, and it goes all the way up the food chain after you've already been traumatized. It's been a horrible thing. And then someone just says, oh, yeah, you're right. Yes. It's fine.
Well, the important thing was, I thought, I mean, they made me so, I said, well, you talk to my doctor. They said, no, they said, you're under the jurisdiction of the fire department. And so I started to cry. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started to sob and wail, and going through my head while this is going on is thinking, am I really crying like this? Or is this just the only move left? I really wondered about it, but I think it was absolutely real. I was driven absolutely crazy. I was sobbing hysterically, but I remember thinking, is this the only move left? And it was, because they then said, oh, of course we'll call the fire department doctor. And then the doctor couldn't have been nicer. And he said, of course, we'll just pick up your husband and put him back in bed. But by that time, we'd been arguing with my husband on the floor for 40 mm-hmm. minutes. I mean, and I was just, I think if you think you can plan a death, you are a big fool. Because I mean, I'm thinking, I want to give Jerry this gift. I want him to die in our bedroom. I want it, it's so pretty here. And I love our apartment on 10th Street. And then it just all goes haywire. And because really, it's not something you can plan. You can do your best.
Well, that's
you
part
can
of
do your best.
One of the lessons of the book is you really can't plan. You can't plan for when love is going to find you again. You can't plan
that's right.
for everything is going great and then you get sick. That you just really can't plan was one of the things I got out of the book. And I'm also curious, like what you got out of rereading your own story.
Well, it really did work out. It worked out just so much of the trauma from the illness, and turning it into something that people love and that makes people laugh as well as cry. That's a huge thing for me, both things. And so I got to make something out of it. But, and also I love eccentric things. And I met Peter because my internet crashed, because I was just trying to disconnect Jerry's landline and Verizon just messed up so badly. And it turns out that's a universal experience. The problem of disconnecting a mate's phone can turn into, I got so much mail on that piece and it was so popular. But then what did it turn out? It's the reason that Peter found out I was, quote, available. And and he wrote me, and I get this letter. It's totally charming letter from a psychiatrist. And by the way, that was the other strange thing. I had just been invited to speak at a Jungian conference in Texas. And I thought, what's a Jungian? I better meet one and find out. And then Peter writes like a second line of his email, I'm a Jungian analyst. And I thought, oh my God, here he is,
The universe and delivered him to your doorstep.
Yes, they did. And it was the most charming note. I have absolutely no memory of our date. I dates date or dates or I can't remember it. Peter said we weren't meant to be together then. And it's true. But it was, you know, I think falling in love is often a completely unexpected thing. And this was completely unexpected. And I didn't even realize I was open to it, which I absolutely was. But I think that when you're older, if you do fall in love, some of it is easier because, you know, you're not working out everything else. You're not trying to figure out how you can have a career and how to raise your children and all these other things. You know, in fact, Peter's now retired, so he's not really coping with the stress of patience now. And so, you know, you have more time to really enjoy it.
My guest is Delia Ephron. The name of the book is Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. So yeah, Peter comes into your life. It's the confluence, the Verizon story, the you went out as a young people story. When you think about the connection that you two have, how would you describe it? And how has it evolved? Because you fell in love over the written word, which
yes,
is lovely.
You know, that is, I mean, for a writer, of course. And Peter had actually written two books. I mean, that was the other amazing thing. When I Googled him, I found out that he was an expert in sexual harassment and had testified on behalf of abused women in court. So he was such a substantive man and rather remarkable. So getting to know him was amazing. And yeah, the written word, if you're a writer, you can always tell from something written to you who the person is and what they're about. And so that was important, I guess. But the romance of it, you know, having lost Jerry and then before that lost Norris, and that was in 2012, I had a lot of sadness. And the thing about romance is it wipes everything out. It sends you into a state of, you know, excessive bliss. I mean, the sexual attraction, the emotional, the excitement of getting the next email or the next phone call, talking on the phone late into the night, discovering another person, you know, discovering something new and fresh. And I mean, it's such a powerful thing. I really tried to capture that. I used all our emails in the book so that you could really understand the power of falling in love.
That was my next question. You let us read your email in the book.
There was no other way to tell our story as effectively. I mean, so that you knew us both intimately. Yeah, I was worried. When Peter read the book, I was a little worried, obviously. I was very glad he was retired. but he said, you know, he loved the book so much. He could see that it was necessary for our story. And then, of course, you know, the really stunning tragedy, which was that 4 months, in the height of this love affair, 4 months later, I was diagnosed with AML, which is a fierce leukemia. And we were thrust into an entire other phase just overnight.
You know, how did your experience as a partner to Jerry during his cancer change the way you thought about your own diagnosis and treatment and you being the patient and someone else being the caregiver?
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think I've actually, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is. I think that when you get sick, it's so, you are who you are. I mean, I'm not somebody who Googles illness or any of that stuff. And then when I got sick, I didn't either. And I didn't, when Jerry got sick, I felt a lot of guilt about Jerry's illness. I felt that people said things to me like, oh, he should have had surgery. That's why he died, because he had radiation. People can be just remarkably mean and clueless and thoughtless, really just thoughtless. And you know, I had all this guilt about had I guided him properly, if I'd made this decision instead of that decision. I think when you lose your husband, I did anyway. I went over and over it. I was rather consumed with guilt. And I think it must have shown on my face that I was like injured, because I felt that the world felt they could say things to me. You know, I mean, that was a doctor that said to me, "Oh, what treatment did your husband have?" I said, "Radiation." He said, "That's why he died." I mean, right away, just putting a knife right into me. Was an eye doctor? I mean, what business did he have having an opinion on that? You know what I mean? And I didn't ask him. And I was so angry. And I said to him, "How can you say that to me?" He said, "Oh, well, you did what you did." You know, and I just thought, this is so terrible. So that I think I had so much guilt. And then when I got sick, the fact that you're looking at a fatal diagnosis, it blocks out almost everything else except that fact. Hmm. You become such a center of your own attention. I felt that one of the amazing blessings of Peter is that he is a doctor. He's been to medical school. He's comfortable in hospitals. And even better, he's a doctor of the heart and soul. He's a psychiatrist. So I had someone who understood the science, and that was just another miracle to me, another strange confluence that and he went to every appointment with me. And I mean, he took immediate leave from his practice, and then he began to do his patients on Zoom. So he was at my side. And the other thing was that my cancer required a kind of almost constant treatment, where I was going to the hospital all the time, you know, and my Jerry's did not require that, but I went to all his appointments. Mm-hmm. And still I just felt, when I saw the way Peter took care of me, I felt even more that I couldn't have done it that well. As much love as I gave Jerry, I didn't. Yeah, well, guilt. I'll tell you, I don't think there's any. There may be people who just know that they did everything they could, mm-hmm. but I think there's just always some part of you that wonders if you've done this or that.
Everyone does their best in those situations.
Yeah,
you did your best.
You do the best you can.
You do your best.
Right. I mean, it's like I just knew. I saw when my sister that she was. She researched everything. She knew all the language of her illness.
But she's a journalist. You say that.
That is exactly. Right? I say that. She's a journalist. That's what journalists do. And I'm not. I don't like to do things that require me to call up people and assemble all the facts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, who you are is who you are.
My guest is Delia Ephron. The name of the book is Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. I also just want to stress that about the book and about your illness is it. You were profoundly ill. You were in the hospital a really long time.
Yes.
And you share some of the medical notes, and they say things like failure to thrive. And mm-hmm. in your illness, you questioned whether or not you wanted to continue on. And you're very clear about that in the book and honest about it. What got you through those moments of despair?
I there were two things. I think, first of all, at that point, oh my God, just let me say, I had a stem cell transplant, and that means you go into the hospital and you are subjected to enormous amounts of chemotherapy, and your body is then given these stem cells, in my case, from an adult donor as well as from the cord blood of a baby, because I did not have a stem cell match. So the way it works is the adult donor takes care of you until the baby cord blood migrates to your marrow and begins to multiply. It's a very cutting edge thing. And you get very, very sick. I mean, the chemo is rough. I lost weight. I stopped eating. And the amount of pills you're taking a day is staggering. And it's not something I've ever had an easy time with. And you have a lot of graft versus host disease, which means that your body's rejecting the transplant. So I got, at one point, my lungs filled with fluid, and that can actually kill you. So one, I got so worn from it that I went into a massive depression. And Peter, being a shrink, knew that I could not be allowed to make decisions based on that, on the state I was in. And I was begging everybody to let me go. I understand depression now in a way that I was never a depressive. And all you want, you don't care about anyone or anything. You just want to escape. And I just wanted a black screen, and Peter wouldn't let me. And I called in, I began summoning all my doctors to visit me and begging them. It turns out, of course, you can't just kill someone because they ask you to in New York. But I was saying, you know, just put me on something, please, and let me get sicker. And my doctor, Dr. Gail Robos at Weill Cornell, who's head of the leukemia program there, she said, what's going on? You know, and I said, you know, please, just, I can't take another pill. And she said, give me 48 hours. And if I get somewhere, give me another 48. And it was like hope and an end game in one sentence, right? Mm-hmm. And I wanted hope. I mean, underneath it all, I did want hope. But I also wanted to know that she heard me. So, you know, the next thing I remembered is that I woke up. I mean, there were many blanks in this story that I had to find out by interviewing my girlfriends who were with me on this trip, as well as Peter. And I woke up and suddenly the room was bright and friendly and Peter looked so handsome. And, you know, I knew that my depression had broken. And it was when I sort of thought, I'm starting to heal. And it had been a 48-hour period where they managed to drain my lungs of the fluid. Mm. And I turned a corner. I ate my first food the next day. It was a hard-boiled egg. And, you know, how did I get through? I had great medicine and great love. And I was careful about who I took on the journey. I can't mm-hmm. say that strongly enough because many of us will face scary journeys like this. Be careful who goes with you. And you know the answer to that question before you invite them. You do know. And I had just remarkable friends, And you can't have a lot of people, by the way. It's not a party.
I like that idea. I like the ending on that idea. Be careful who you take with. It's not a party, but no. And everybody knows. We know who those people are. Right now, there are people sitting, thinking, listening, saying, I know who those people are.
Yeah, I know who I need. Yeah.
The name of the book is Left on 10th, A Second Chance at Life. I've been speaking with Delia Efron about her memoir. Delia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Allison. I've just enjoyed it. Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.